This is the weekly podcast from radiotoday.co.uk. It's episode 186, if you're interested. I'm Trevor Down, and this week we're back at Jazz FM in central London, who've kindly agreed to host our second monthly roundtable. On the agenda, sweary radio, digital radio, Christmas radio, conferences and awards. Do we have too many these days? And some terrific recommendations for your future listening pleasure. Let's meet the panel.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
I'm Adam Bowie and I'm Commercial Strategy Manager at the BBC World Service.
Phil Critchlow, I'm CEO of TBI Media.
Award winning.
I'm Nikki Birch and I'm the founder of Rosina Sound.
I'm Chloe Straw, so slightly confusingly, I've just left my current role, which is exec producer for something else, and I'm going in January to take up a role of head of content and production at We Are Grape.
And what are they?
We Are Grape are also a content company, so they make shows for Radio 1, including Pete Tong and Annie Nightingale. They also make content for Spotify, Sirius in the US, and BBC Music.
So we have a lot of independent production expertise around the table, and we have Adam, who can analyse the work of others. Adam, can I start with you? We want to talk about Ofcom. The report on digital radio, it could make dull reading, but do you draw anything interesting from it?
Yeah, I mean, it's this annual thing that Ofcom have to put out as a sort of road to a potential switch over, and so it's just a state of play really with some of Rajar research, some of Ofcom's own numbers, and a bit of third party data mixed in. And I think the key thing is we're at about 45.5% of all radio listening is now digital, and that's the number anyone who's sort of following the trade press will have seen bandied around. Some parts of the country it's a bit more, notably in a lot bunch of sort of southern areas it's broken 50%, and it's also for some younger audiences it's broken 50% of listening is now digital.
It tends to be higher in Remain constituencies, I saw.
I hadn't quite put that spin on it, I must admit.
Nikki, you've just done a report for the British Library about the future of radio. So what do you learn from what Adam's been talking about and from your own work on the future in terms of digital?
It's very exciting times coming up, but there's a sort of when is the digitisation of radio, and I mean digitisation in terms of the march of the internet rather than digital radio, coming to radio, and it feels like it is coming, it is looming, but how fast it's coming is kind of still, I suppose, up in the air, and people disagree about that. That's the kind of summary of the report,
really. Are people, younger people, perhaps than some of us around this table, just ignoring DAB and going straight from FM to the internet?
I don't think it's as simple as that, actually. It's not about platform, it's about content. We all know that, really, anyway. But it's about what they're listening to and how they're accessing it. So I suppose in that respect, it is about platform slightly, but it's not saying I'm just listening to an internet radio station. You know, we haven't seen a loss of people listening to Radio 1 and now turning on to NTS. It's not as simple as that. You know, it's not clear. It's about how they're getting their content in more modular, bite-sized form. They're listening to audio in various different guises and where it comes in. It's about that share of ear problem that we all know and kind of have talked about before. So it's really, I suppose, the future, the worry from the radio industry seems to be, and there's not kind of a sort of a definitive argument about this, is whether the people who are listening aren't listening to radio in younger people, whether they will come back to radio. And that sort of, there's been some studies, I think BBC did a study where they interviewed the same people kind of 10 years on, and but it was such a small study, but they found those people weren't coming back to radio. But that was such a small study, they kind of discarded it because it was only about sort of 20 people. But there's still, that really we don't know is the answer.
So Chloe, you make programmes now and you'll be making a lot more in the future for that younger demo, and you used to look after something else's pop music for Radio 1. Mm. What does that experience tell you about the changes?
I think just that Radio 1's got a really difficult task. You know, Ben's very open about it in terms of the challenges that face Radio 1, and it sort of backs up exactly what Nikki's said in terms of it's not just about radio listening and is it digital, is it, you know, online or whatever. It's about all the other competing things in terms of social media, YouTube, Spotify, Beats One, so many different things. It's sort of competing for share of ear now rather than it just being about radio.
Phil, Chloe described herself as a creator of content. Do you think your company is a content maker, or is it still a media production company? And are they different things?
I don't think they're that different, really. Fundamentally, you tell a story on the right platform for that story. And we happen to have our roots in radio, and we're very proud of that. But we also do visualised content. We do prints. We co-release books. We release music. We sell tickets for events. There are lots of different ways in which you can take content and monetize it. One of them is selling programs to the BBC and commercial radio. So we are a content agency, like any number of content agencies around London and outside of London.
Can you be any longer a radio production company, or do you have to think multi-platform?
I think you can be a someone who is passionate about producing radio and produce that as your the principal thing that you do. I think doing that on a larger scale becomes difficult because the scale involved in running a lot of radio, it's quite a marginal thing to do. So you need to, almost all the indies that have grown and developed have supplemented their radio income with other things. And that's out of necessity rather than, you know, it starts with necessity and then it becomes something that's actually quite good to do.
Nikki, what did you learn about podcasts?
Well, actually, I've just come back from Third Coast as well. So maybe we'll come on to talk about this in conferences. We're going to touch on conferences later. But I wouldn't be surprised that if we're going to see a renaissance in audio production companies. And I mean that by not of the scale that perhaps that Phil's talking. I agree with Phil. If you're trying to get scale like something else in TBI, and you know, then you do have to diversify. But there are so many opportunities coming out with Compete and Compare with the BBC, but also with podcasting and with Audible and all these. I think actually there's revenue to be made now in radio and people recognising that. And also you can do that with just being one or two or three people. So I think the sense is that there's a sort of a resurgence in love of radio for radio's sake.
So cottage industry production companies might have a resurgence.
Yeah, I think they will.
I think as well, for me, it's not necessarily about scale because something else makes such a huge amount of radio, like it's enormous, then their sort of growth has always been a lot to do with radio. But maybe it's about scaling creatively. You know, if you do a lot of radio and you do it really well, you want to go into social media. I mean, we do social media for the BBC Pop Hub as well, so it's a natural companion. And also because the two are so interchangeable now, it makes a lot of sense to do it together and for the same company to do it together, because then you get that sort of creative input from lots of different people, and you get the communication, which is really valuable as well. So it's almost about scaling creatively as well as sort of scaling size-wise, really, in terms of the expansion.
Adam, can the smaller companies ever hope to survive? Can they make money? Is the market growing?
The market clearly is growing. I think the concern is always, can you make enough margin on some of these things, and you know, is that sustainable as a living for someone, you know, so they can go on their own and they can probably win one or two productions, but is that enough to actually survive on? I mean, I think, you know, it's not the same, but if you look at the television industry and what's happened, there were, you know, initially in the early indie sector, lots of very small spin-offs, and over time they sort of consolidated, and now you've got, you know, super indies and half of them are owned by America, and if they're not American, they're ITV. It's a different marketplace, but you can certainly see the same kind of things if the opportunities are there.
I mean, I certainly think that it's in every indie audio producer's best interest to think, as has been said by Chloe, to think about the other things that are fun to do off the back of doing something which is primarily audio. Not only fun to do, but rewarding, and will supplement and enhance what you've done with the audio. And hopefully that will generate revenue as well. There is a natural progression from the point at which you make radio and you think, well, let's point a camera at it. Will that be interesting? And if the answer is yes, then do it. If it's no, then don't. It depends on the story. And as I said at the very beginning, it's about marrying that story to the right platform. And if you do that, the audience will come.
There's a very good piece recently in BuzzFeed about James O'Brien and LBC and how he's gone, managed to find a way of making his little rants into viral content. Yeah. It's really good stuff, isn't it? And he says something quite interesting in there, which is it's made a difference that their studios at Global now look like television studios. Because we used to think that didn't sort of matter, that you could be in a broom cupboard. He says it's really lifted their profile.
Okay. Yeah, I came across him because of that on Facebook. So, I mean, that in itself is, you know, I wouldn't listen to LBC generally, and I've come across him because of that, because it gets shared so much. So,
But it is interesting, isn't it, that it's video, and video is shareable and audio is very hard to share, and that's been one of the things. So that works for some things, but other kinds of audio, you know, do you have to do animation or something else? You know, and I think sharing audio is still a challenge that we've got to sort of face and get over. I think
technology is helping us, though. Things are changing, and like technology is helping in James O'Brien, because they've been able to edit and quickly get that content out and put it out on Facebook. But technology now, where you have speech to text content, have you seen the shortcuts run from This American Life, where they it's powered by a pop-up archive, and anyone can do this actually if they have podcasts, where you can basically take a section of the program and it automatically adds text to it and turns it into a little video, an animated video with text, and you can then share it. So I think technology is helping us, and we're solving that problem, just like it's solving the problem of discoverability in podcasting and all these sort of things. So I think things are changing, and that's what I come back to. Things are changing for audio at the moment, and it's a bit slow. It's been a bit slow. It's been a bit late to the party, but it's getting there now. And I think people are starting to do things like share it, take it seriously. There's monetizing involved, you know. So I think that's why I feel quite confident we're in a bit of a new dawn.
This is the Radio Today programme. It's entirely uncontaminated by visuals right now. Nikki Birch, you mentioned the Third Coast Festival. This is the festival for basically NPR people. It happens in Chicago. What was it like?
It was the day after Trump got elected. So
Nice mood there then.
Yeah, and if you can imagine the podcaster or crowd in America, they are not Trump fans. So every single session started with "In this time," which was quite kind of amusing. But it was fascinating, actually. It was fascinating to see a festival done to a completely different scale. It was really very positive. It was about learning. It was about sharing ideas. It was definitely about kind of mingling and meeting. It was 3 days in one hotel. And I've never seen a festival or an event where there are stalls of people with lists of jobs. I mean, it's like the podcast boom is heaving there. You have NPR saying, "These are all the jobs I want." Audible, like, "These are all the people." People running around going, "I need an editor. I've flown all the way from New York. I need an editor. Can you be my editor?" You know, from the New York Times. It was absolutely insane. It's really got the sense of, like, wow, there's money in podcasting in America at the moment.
You've come back quite motivated, haven't you?
I am totally. I'm on board. Sign me up.
There are people listening to this thinking, is that the Nikki Birch we know? Now, I went to it a few years ago, and you're absolutely right that there is no sense of competition amongst the people there. They all feel as though they're on the same side. I felt it was almost like a party political conference, that they were all there to say they agreed with each other. Which is quite nurturing in a way.
Yeah, and I think actually we could take a lot if we're in terms of organising things like the radio festival here, because we could take a lot from them, because our radio festival is like a sort of show. It's like, we're radio, da-da, and we're great, and that's lovely and wonderful. But there it was like, okay, how do you learn about creating stories with sound? How do we sell our programme in 10 words? How, these are all the sort of types of sessions which were really useful. And, like, you know, and afterwards you went up to the speaker and you asked them lots of questions about it. And it was just really valuable. Everyone was giving out cards. You know, it was one of those sense where you thought, OK, this is really valuable. I've really learned something and I've met lots of people.
Are there sessions online? Can you go and
you
check
can
them
listen
out?
To them.
You can listen. Only. Quite right, too.
And lots of sessions, I'd like to say, lots of sessions were presented by British people. So lots of good British representation.
While we're talking about conferences then and awards, we've all noticed, haven't we, that there was hardly anything for the radio industry for the large part of 2016, and then we got to the autumn and suddenly we had Next and the festival and the ARIAs and the APAs and this, you know, we just had a great confluence of them. What are we going to do to try and make some sense out of the radio calendar, Phil?
I mean, the first thing to say, I guess, is it's great that we have these opportunities to celebrate radio, and it's great that the ARIAs are back. I think they did a brilliant job up in Leeds. I think this has passed everyone's expectations. Inevitably, there are things to discuss, and I know that the team who did that are very open to that. It was good to see the APAs in great form only a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, the team who did that did a great job. I think now it's a question, and I know people are doing this, everyone just needs to sit down and spread it out a little bit across the year. And I know that that process is in place. And it makes
I do have some hot news on this, actually, because I spoke to Roger Cutsforth at the Academy this morning, and he tells me that they are in discussions about moving the festival back to the spring, and they know that that would mean they'd have to do another one within, you know, less than a year, but they think that's the right thing to do to try and at least pull it away. And I know that there are other discussions going on between the Radio Centre and the ARIAs, and I don't know whether the APAs are yet involved in that, are they, Phil?
They're going to have to be. You know, I know that yes.
I mean, this isn't about making announcements, but I think it's good to say that the industry, all the
is coordinated.
Parts of it are talking to each other.
And again, I'm not trying to hide anything, to be honest. Those discussions are largely led by Will at RIG. But certainly it makes sense for us as a sector to coordinate the way that we give these awards out. I mean, the principal reason for the good thing about having awards is it motivates people to go just that little bit further. When you're doing a late night edit, it's 1:30 and you're thinking, do I make it that extra 3% better just because I can? If there is the prospect of, in the old days, the Sony, now the ARIA, the APA, the new, whatever it would be, it might just encourage people to go that little bit further. That's not the only reason why they make sense, but it's a good thing, I think, to have a moment where we celebrate great radio.
Have you enjoyed Nikki, Chloe, winning awards?
Yeah, have you enjoyed
many
them?
Years ago. Yeah.
You've both won awards now, come on. Let's not be overmodest.
No, I'm not being. I have won them. I think, being brutally honest, they're not that important to me, which is, I probably shouldn't say, but sorry to disagree with you, Phil, but the reason I make great radio is to make great radio, and I get that about pushing it over the edge, but I think for me it's what's the purpose of the awards. And it's definitely, you know, I've seen people I manage win awards and it's brilliant for them, and it's brilliant for their motivation, so that's the thing. But I guess because there's so many different sort of little ones, in some ways it feels like, do you want something that's outward facing, so something like the BAFTAs? Do you want one big annual awards ceremony that's really glitzy, gets a lot of attention and sort of shouts to the world about audio and radio? Or do you want lots of little ones, I guess? And those are really nice because they potentially give more people a chance of winning, which is the thing about motivation. But I guess the question for me would be, what's the purpose of the awards, perhaps? So,
I think awards do matter. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes back to, you know, who you are and what you're doing. Yeah. And, you know, I think if you're in a station that's won Station of the Year, mm-hmm. that's an incredible fillip mm-hmm. to everyone who works there. And I always feel, you know, it's not everyone is a front line is going to be up for an award. Yeah. And so that's the best that they can get. And, you know, I like to think as well, there's career prospects are improved as well by winning awards, you know, and you can move on and maybe get up the next level.
Doesn't work at the BBC, because as soon as you win a few New York awards, you don't get any commissions at all. Or is that just me?
But what I was going to say about some of the events, I think it's also worth saying that not everyone goes to everything. Now, maybe some of the people in this room are lucky enough to get along to a lot of these things. But, you know, so a few of us were at TechCon last week, but that's very much for an engineering community. And they're not, with the best will in the world, going to go to maybe the ARIAs unless they are specifically up, because that's a different kind of thing. And there are different groups. If you're in sales and commercial radio, you maybe go to different things there. Certainly in the days of the Sonys, it was very much production focused. Obviously, it's the presenters, it's the talent, it's the people who make the radio who are going to those, or the audio. And so not everyone gets to go to everything. So although, yes, sometimes it seems like a bit of a collision, you know, and we have had a lot this autumn. There is no doubt about that. But not everyone gets to go to everything.
We are Adam Bowen, Phil Critchlow and Nikki Birch and Chloe Straw. And I'm Trevor Dan. And we're at the Radio Today programme Round Table number 2. Now, let's just take a pause for this. Christmas time. Yeah, let's stop that now. Is there too much Christmas music on the radio in more than one word? Chloe?
Depends on the audience, I'm going to go with. So, very, very different depending on which station you're listening to.
What do we think is the right time to start playing Christmas music for, let's say, a Radio 1 audience?
I mean, I'm going to make a sweeping generalisation.
Most people do that.
Yeah, based on no evidence. That's fine.
That's how we roll.
So I would say potentially for the Radio 1 audience slightly later, because, you know, you're thinking of the sort of purpose of Radio 1 is it's a young audience, it's very current, and obviously Christmas music always has a sort of heritage feel in many ways. You don't often get a lot of new Christmas music released, and I think Radio 1 needs to continue serving its purpose to sort of serve new music out there. Equally, everyone loves a bit of Christmas music, so you don't want none on there, but you just want to think carefully about when you put it on. Whereas I guess perhaps for stations with a sort of slightly older audience in mind, I know that as soon as the 1st of December comes, I put Michael Bublé on, but I'm obviously well out of the Radio 1 audience age now, so it's just thinking about things like that. I mean, it's always about the audience.
Nikki, I saw
great
you
phoning
grimace.
They want their job back, they're going to cancel the job.
Yeah, exactly.
Bublé, she's out.
Nikki, you grimaced when I used the word Christmas.
Oh, yeah, I hate Christmas music. And we had some builders doing some work, and I think they were listening to Smooth Christmas. Could that have been a station for a while? And it did my nut in after a while. So, but you know, I think Clubby said it, each to their own. The people I feel really sorry for, the people who are working in shops, you know, because they just have to listen to it all day, every day, from, you know, probably from sort of October. So I think that's disastrous. I think Six Music do it quite well. They do Christmas music, you know, it's sort of interspersed, and they try and do kind of, you know, punky and kind of Christmas music. That's quite good. The alternative Christmas music I like. However, I would say there comes a point, and it's usually about a week before Christmas, when you've kind of done, you're totally done. And so when you hear stations playing Christmas music on Christmas Day, that's the time I think, no, it's late. You need to be playing like a soulful day or something that's just kind of anything but. So I think you know, there's a starting point, but the end point needs to come now about a week before Christmas.
Phil, when does your sleigh list kick in?
Well, we produced a show at the Palladium a week last Sunday, which was full of Christmas music, so it would be wrong of me to say it couldn't happen before that point. And actually, there's some brilliant Christmas music in that. Emily Sandé sang, you know, there was some great stuff happening. So,
what did she sing?
She sang
Fairy Tale in New York.
She didn't sing Fairy Tale in New York. She sang Come All You Faithful, which she did as a blues gospel thing, which is fantastic. I mean, equally, Birdie did her version of Walking the Air, which actually was extraordinary. And the whole of the Palladium was silent for seconds after it finished before they started applauding. So it depends on the music.
Is that better, Nikki? Could you stand those?
No, I think that sounds lovely, actually. Yeah. I like a bit of Emily Sandé. You know, she's great.
It's a bit more charitable.
And you know, Beverly Knight was singing a gospel version of Christmas stuff. So I'm not going to say Bah Humbug. I like a good Christmas tune, but it needs to be a good Christmas tune, and you need to balance it against the audience. I absolutely agree that my kids who listen to Radio 1 really don't want to be hearing much about Christmas before a couple of weeks before, and Christmas Eve is absolutely the cut-off point.
Adam, all these Christmas stations, are they just there to sell advertising?
Yeah, of course, clearly. I mean, some people, you know, and some people just turn it on. I mean, the great thing about digital is you can just jump to a particular genre and just get it. You know, I want 80s, I want Christmas, I want whatever. Me personally, I don't want to hear Fairy Tale New York one more time this Christmas. I'm sorry, it's a great song, but I just once every year is enough.
Have you heard about Whamageddon? There's a game which you have to play.
That just sounds hideous.
No, it's a game. You should try it, okay? It's a game basically called Whamageddon, that the first time you hear Last Christmas, you have to tweet hashtag Whamageddon, and the last person to do it is kind of the winner.
Social media at its best. Talking of Ofcom, we can't move on without discussing Pinky Pinky. For those of you listening who haven't seen this, this is the most vulgar record ever played on the radio, is it not, Adam?
I think it's quite easily, and by a long way. I mean, if you put Derek and Clive on and just played it full, that's way less offensive.
It is. This is offensive in a racial sense, yep. In a religious sense.
Yeah, it ticks most of the boxes.
Where is Canshi Radio, by the way? Do we know that?
I'm not sure, actually.
Anyway, may not be there much longer.
I'm surprised they didn't get fined, though. I just think back to what's happened in the past. I mean, there were a lot of breaches held against them, but Ofcom could hit them with quite a large fine.
I just wondered if any of us around the table have been responsible for bad language being played on the radio, and they're going to talk about this. You mentioned Annie Nightingale earlier. Yeah. I was at Radio 1 when she played Star Star by the Rolling Stones, right, which has got about 26 Fox in it. And I remember Are we allowed to say Dave Lee and Travis? Probably we are. Anyway, he played Who the Fuck Are You
right.
by The Who. That was a nice moment at 12:45.
Yeah. In the afternoon.
Yeah.
Right.
Any other stories of poor language on the radio that we'd like to share?
Well, I've been in the studio where poor language has happened on the radio, but I've not necessarily planned it to happen on the radio,
exactly.
To be honest. So, it's happened, but not on purpose.
I think translation is the interesting thing here. I mean, this was not in English. It was in, I think, is it Punjabi?
There are bits of English in it.
English in it. Oh, okay, great. When I was working at something else with Chloe, you know, you would make sure that your producers who are playing things in foreign languages would get them translated. And that's a basic thing. And this is obviously a small station, you know, so there probably isn't the resource there. But the fact that they played it twice is the really kind of really stupid thing. And then came up with a really hilarious story about being robbed and having to get replacement CDs. So, you know, is that whole thing of just say sorry, please.
Yeah, it was almost like they'd said, someone broke in and put this record into our playout system. We knew nothing about it.
I really recommend you should go and have a look at the lyrics because they are hilariously offensive. They're so bad. They will make every single mistake you've ever made in radio.
Adam, you were saying a friend of yours had tried to find it on Spotify.
It turns out that they haven't really got every track known to man.
Let's not give it any more publicity. Let's finish, as we always do, by just asking our panel what they've been listening to. Chloe, I know what your choice is. So tell me more about Birth Hour.
Birth Hour. So I love listening to something called The Birth Hour, which is a podcast. It's American, and it's basically women sharing stories of giving birth. So I have got two kids. They're 4 and 2. So it's something that's still relatively fresh in my mind, I guess. And one of the big things when I was preparing for giving birth was reading a lot of positive stories in terms of sort of refocusing my mind on positives rather than negatives. And I think, as a lot of people do, I love hearing birth stories, particularly when you've given birth. I don't watch One Born Every Minute because I think it's an unfair representation of what giving birth is like. And it's just wonderful in its storytelling
in terms of American frankness as well, hasn't it?
It has. And there's not a lot of UK podcasts. I mean, Nikki, maybe you've come across some that match it, really. Birth is something that I'm just interested in because it's something that really sort of had an effect on me.
Just drill down a little bit more. What is it about the way Americans deal with these issues in their podcasts that we, by and large, don't on the radio? You know, if Birth Hour was on 5 Live or Radio 4, it would have a different feel to it. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, I think it's largely unedited. So it's sort of the mother's story in her own words. And, you know, it talks about everything that has happened, you know, from if it hurt or if it didn't hurt, to baby coming out, to, you know, their vaginas, if you're really going into it. So it's really frank, it's unedited, and the story is allowed to just go where it wants to go. So it's sort of, without sounding too cheesy, like a river, and that it ebbs and flows, but there's no harsh editing to it, nothing sort of cut out, and it's incredibly personal and very, very intimate.
I think my water just broke. I felt like things really intensified.
She was right there and she was coming.
It was an amazing feeling.
I'm gonna cry just thinking about it. I could feel her head.
We heard her cry. We were squeezing hands and she was screaming.
I'm Bryn Hunt Palmer and you're listening to The Birth Hour. This podcast is designed as a safe place for women to come together to share their childbirth stories. Stick around and join us to hear informative and empowering birth journeys from women all over the world.
And there's quite a few. There's another American podcast called The Longest Shortest Time, which is about parenting, but it's a really similar thing. It really manages to drill down. But I think a lot of that isn't necessarily in the skill of the presenter. It's just that the, storyteller, the interviewee, is allowed just to tell their story without too many interruptions.
And that's such an important thing, isn't it, about the difference between podcasting and broadcasting? That it's such an obvious thing to say, but the fact that you haven't got any time constraints means that you never have to think, oh, I've got to fit this into my 3-minute slot. Nikki?
Yeah, there's a lot talked about kind of difference between American and British style and other international styles. But I think what the Americans do is they focus on human stories a lot. And it's not necessarily on that kind of what's the bigger message here. You know, if you're pitching to Radio 4, you have a it's a story about a pen, but really it's symptomatic about how technology is changing our whole life. You know, whereas Americans, it's just like that pen is fascinating. Let's hear about the pen. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like they just like the stories and the human stories.
That's the clip for the trail, by the way, Hayley, if we made one, which we don't. Let's find out what Phil's been listening to.
Two, three things. I mean, I guess I'd definitely recommend you check out Birdie's version of The Snowman, because it's great.
And what, that's on Radio 2?
No, that's on Magic, on the website. I think you can find it on the Magic.
Commercial Radio buys independent production shock.
Big show for them. Then I did listen to a really good afternoon drama on Radio 4, which was called Stone, which I downloaded and listened to in the car, because that's where I normally listen. And it's just brilliant that there are still these things happening that I can download, take with me and listen to 45 minutes in the car and just really enjoy good radio drama. And that's part of a series, I think it's three or four, and I'll certainly be going back and also going forward with that. And finally, it's not really radio, but I did watch Benji's mix against the Planet Earth stuff last night, and I would listen to that mix as audio only.
I listened to the Rodigan ones. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
It's such a great idea. It's a great way to use that archive again in a different way. You can imagine it being part of someone's kind of consumption of stuff in a way that's halfway between radio and telly, which I think is good, but the audio stands up on its own. Benji's such a great curator.
Yeah, last week I went to an In the Dark event at the British Library, actually, and it was about a guy who I didn't know anything about, a dramatist called Giles Cooper, who died in the mid-60s, which is why I didn't know a great deal about him. And basically, the guys from In the Dark and also a chap from Bournemouth University have unearthed a bunch of his old plays and were playing excerpts from them. And they really stand the test of time. It was this, Giles Cooper, he'd lived the war, and he had a very kind of surrealist, sort of strays into almost the Goons, Spike Milligan, that kind of thing, attitude, that post-war, you had to get through it. And Bournemouth University have just packaged together a CD set, which I couldn't find on the website, but I'm sure it'll end up there soon. And if you ever watched or listened to The History Boys, for example, you can definitely hear that Alan Bennett was well aware of his stuff, because there are complete links through to some of those kind of things. But there were some really good dramas there.
We present a play by Giles Cooper entitled The Disagreeable Oyster.
You can say that again.
The Disagreeable Oyster.
They do disagree with me. But how was I to know when I stood on the steps of the Rosedean Family and Commercial Hotel thinking that the world was my oyster? That...
Begin at the beginning.
Oh, the beginning is at 12 o'clock on a Saturday morning in my office at Craddock's Calculators Limited. It is not a nice office. Even the typing pool have a narrow view of St. Paul's. But poor old Bundy...
My name, Mervyn Bundy.
Deputy Head of Costing, has to put up with an office looking out on an air shaft, and all I can see is the upstairs part of a mercantile bank.
Well?
That's the beginning.
Nicky.
Well, I'm listening. I've always been a long-term Five Live listener, so I just wanted to, like, I love Question Time Extra Time. I love watching Question Time, and then I love finding more about what people think. I think it's fantastic. Love Stephen Nolan. But in terms of things that perhaps people haven't heard, I've been listening to an American podcast called Codebreaker, which is all about how, it's into its second series at the moment, it's about how technology is changing our lives. So there's a piece, and each time they focus on a different piece of technology. And this last episode I heard was about VR, and they were looking at how VR might impact life in the courtroom from a positive and a negative way. And the clever thing about Codebreaker is that within each programme, they have a code, which if you know what it is, you can unlock the whole series. So there's a kind of game, which I've never been managed to do yet.
That's
but,
clever.
You know, it's a clever little neat idea.
It's a really bizarre scene. Putting them on, it's weird to watch several thousand people all pull out their phones together and put something on their faces.
This is a unique virtual reality experience. When everyone entered the park a couple of hours ago, they were given a free Google Cardboard headset. And that headset is supposed to let you see a whole new world by turning your phone into a face mask, which puts you at the center of a 360-degree video.
Did you figure it out yet?
We're trying. I'm trying to figure out if my nose is going here. It doesn't look like we wear it on our head.
A few hours later, everyone seems to have figured it out. They've downloaded the app, popped in their phones, the sun has gone down, the lights have come up.
Five.
And just at the right moment.
Three. Two. One.
We blast off into this grand experiment.
I want to add in a new podcast that's called 20,000 Hertz, which is all about sound. And apparently 20,000 Hertz is a dog whistle. That's why it has that name. And it's American, and they just talk about a particular sound. And so the latest edition is about the NBC chimes and how they were invented and how they changed. And they've done one about the time signal and all that kind of stuff.
This is the story behind the most famous sound in broadcasting.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
For being only three tiny notes, the NBC chimes have had a colossal impact on media and culture for nearly 90 years. It was back in the late 1920s when NBC started using this for the first time to identify itself on the radio.
WEAF New York.
Absolutely fascinating stuff. Any other business before we depart?
There's a similar one like that actually called Sound Matters as well, which is done by Tim Hinson, who gave a talk about it last night at the Ace Hotel, and that's all about sound, and it's sponsored by Bang & Olufsen. So it's really good if you're really into kind of deep sound and listening about kind of amazing soundscapes. He's a really fantastic kind of auteur of the world of podcasting and audio.
The other thing I'd like to just mention briefly is Eddie Mair's weekly interviews with Steve Hewlett on PM,
yeah,
which have been
amazing.
Really brilliant, haven't they? And one's sort of proud of Steve Hewlett for talking about it as frankly as this is about him talking about it. He's got cancer, and it's not good news, is it?
No, and I heard his son as part of that once, and I've got to say I was incredibly moved by it. Just very frank, very honest, very down to earth. Really powerful.
And
idea.
Human storytelling, as we were just talking about. This has been the Roundtable, number two edition of the Radio Today programme. Adam, thank you. Phil, Nikki, Chloe. Let's hear something that Nikki will recognise, because this is a man from Five Live, Stuart Clarkson, doing the Radio Today news.
Yes, hello, here are this week's top stories from the Radio Today newsroom. Loughborough, Hinckley and Nuneaton have got a local radio station back. Foss 107 has taken over the licence previously held by Oak 107, which closed down in July. Presenters on the new station include Mark Rowley, Mark Foster and James Martin, who are all also directors of Foss Media Limited. Satellite station Kanshi Radio has said sorry for a serious Ofcom breach this week. It played an extremely offensive song, which included most of the most serious offensive words, and it played it twice. The regulator this week ruled the track broke four rules of the Ofcom code. It's now considering what sanctions to impose on Kanshi, and you can check out the full uncensored lyrics to see what they broadcast at radiotoday.co.uk. Wireless Group Network Late Show presenter Emil Franchi is joining UKRD station Star Radio North East in Darlington. Emil's a local lad from County Durham. He'll take over the drive show on Star from the new year. I'm a Celebrity's had another radio winner. Capital North East's Scarlett Moffat was crowned this year's Queen of the Jungle on the ITV show. Fellow radio folk Danny Baker and Lisa Snowden were the first two celebs to leave the series, though. Popular Australian radio duo Hamish and Andy have announced they're quitting radio at the end of 2017. They do a network drive show on stations across the country, but they say they're going to focus on TV work instead. And changes are coming to the Radio 4 schedule from April. The station will say goodbye to midweek. Two new arts programmes are added to the schedule, a monthly theatre show and a long-form interview series with prominent figures from the arts. That's it for this week. From radiotoday.co.uk, I'm Stuart Clarkson.
Thank you, Stuart. David Lloyd's Radio Moments to come after this.
Your best content, shareable and discoverable on any platform.
Oasis from Broadcast Bionics helps you build a closer relationship with your listeners. Welcome to the social studio at bionics.co.uk. Radio Moments,
David Lloyd. It's 4 years now since one of radio's most troublesome periods began. It started with a call from Australia to England.
What about this then?
Kate, my darling, are you there?
Good morning, Mum. This is the nurse speaking. How may I help you?
Hello, I'm just after my granddaughter, Kate. I want to see how her little tummy bug is going.
Mummy! She's sleeping at the moment, she has had an uneventful night. And sleep is good for her as we speak. She's been getting some fluids to rehydrate her because she was quite dehydrated when she came.
Mel Gregg and Michael Christian, the Today FM presenters, calling the hospital where Kate Middleton was and speaking to a nurse on air. 28 years ago, the South Coast got a powerful news station.
Making waves with music, yeah.
Powered FM.
Pure music power for Hampshire, South Wiltshire, West Sussex and the Isle of Wight on 103.2 FM.
Clever use of overlapping transmitters for complementary formats for maybe the first time. Power FM on the South Coast launching as a sister to Ocean this week in 88.
Sunday, December the 4th, 1988, at exactly 10 a.m.
Power, power,
FM.
Give me a beat!
The power is on.
Happy birthday, power. It's now capital. This week last year, we lost Mike Allen.
Well, good morning. Many thanks to James Well, and it's good to see Ash again. I'm Mike Allen, and looking after the shop for Ian Collins and Chessie, and they're just having a bit of time off. They've been working very hard. So it's a bit of an act to follow, but I'll try. I wanted to talk to you about Andrew Gumbel, very, very briefly. He's a journalist, and he wrote last Sunday.
Mike Allen, who died this week in 2015. He was on Capital in the 80s, inspiring so many broadcasters. Later, he was on Talk Radio UK, Smooth, and LBC as well. 4 years ago this week, the BBC Radio News operation moved from TV Centre, and the most famous of programmes moved home.
The World at One. This is Martha Carney with 45 minutes of news and comments.
It's 6 o'clock. Good morning. This is Today with Evan Davis and Justin.
It's 10 o'clock. This is The World Tonight with Robin Lustig.
This is our last programme from Studio S1 in Television Centre. We're moving Broadcasting House to Broadcasting House. We were named partly in shock that in 1998 radio news programmes came here to mingle with those dreadful air-kissing clipboard-holding spray-painted tooth-bleached TV types with polo necks. Since that dark day, this very room has hosted every edition you and I have heard of Today, The World at 1 p.m, The World Tonight, The World This Weekend, and our own offering Before the Archers on a Sunday.
Paddy O'Connell reflecting on the move of BBC Radio News to New Broadcasting House this week in 2012. A few months ago now, we heard Terry Wogan's memorial service live on Radio 2, but last farewells have been broadcast before. This week, 30 years ago, Roger Moffat died, the man who closed the BBC Light programme.
Well, there we end broadcasting in the Light programme, not just for today, but as it seems, forever.
And later fondly heard on Hallam.
May we wish you all a very good night.
Was given the ultimate send-off from colleague Keith Skews in a helicopter.
At 9.15 this morning, we flew over the Hackenthorpe area of Sheffield and scattered part of Roger's ashes over the fields towards Beighton. At a similar time, Sheffield funeral director Richard Heath, of John Heath and Sons, was leaving the city to carry out the second part of Roger's wishes.
When I die, as everybody has to, I would like to see how much I get on, you know, whether I'm on the front page or nowhere at all. It would be nice, but I won't be able to do that.
Farewell Roger Moffat this week in 86. One of the most famous offshore pirates prepared to go on air this week 52 years ago.
Jerry and the Pacemakers at the title one from their new film, their first film, Ferry Across the Mersey, and it's 29 past that big hour of 9 o'clock. We'll be coming your way today right up until 8. Test transmissions from Radio London, number one for fun.
Wonderful Radio London testing this week in 1964.
Right now, though, it's 5 to 11, and we're back to...
Radio London's Fabulous 40.
Radio London was to become the inspiration for Radio 1, and some of the early tier of commercial radio management began there too, including Philip Birch from Piccadilly and Dennis Maitland at Trent.
Well, the first 19 came into being starting in 1974 and were completed in 1976 with Beacon Radio in Wolverhampton as the last one. And then there was a lull before, in 1979, the next wave of stations were opened. BBC went from the then 20 to 30, where it's remained.
Dennis Maitland speaking during the early days of land-based commercial radio. He was the first Trent MD, and he later ran Radio Air too. BBC local radio is pretty good with local causes, so when snowy conditions hit Brighton this week in 1967, BBC Radio Brighton rose to the challenge, even though it wasn't actually properly on air.
This is BBC Radio Brighton, on the air for the very first time, over 2 months ahead of our official starting date of February the 14th. In fact, the weather conditions here are so severe and are having such a great and serious effect on our local community, it was decided that we would try and see if we could offer you an emergency service just at least during the period of severe weather. Two more areas are now completely cut off. We've just heard from East Sussex Police that both Rotting Dean and Salt Dean are completely isolated. They join New Haven and
the Seaport. Early breaths of BBC Radio Brighton. Frank Gillard, who ran BBC local radio at the outset, had to ask the post office for permission to go on air early. They controlled things back then. So with Ginger Media and Apax buying Virgin for £85 million 19 years ago...
I mean, I paid for most of the computers and pictures on the wall and things like that.
Margaret Thatcher randomly calling the Today programme 28 years ago...
Hello, good morning.
Absolute 80s launching 7 years ago...
The UK's only 80s radio station.
And Radio Luxembourg's first major transmitter switched on at 150 kilowatts on long wave 83 years ago...
You must remember that in these days, of course, the BBC had no light entertainment on a Sunday.
Those are this week's Radio Moments. Radio
Moments. More from David next week. Thanks to him, also to researcher Hayley Hayes, to Jazz FM for hosting our second round table. We'll have another one of those in January, by the way. Thanks to Chloe, Nikki, Phil and Adam for taking part, to Stu for the news, and of course you for listening. Quite long this week, wasn't it? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Let me know. I'm Trevor at trevordan.com. Cheers.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.